following is the second in a series of classes given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J., on vocation formation. This is part one of Father's talk on practical methods of mental prayer, Father John Hardin.
The next section is on practical methods of mental prayer. I'm not sure I mentioned this the last time we met. What I would like to do is to first share with you, before we talk about the methods themselves, to say something and at some length on the predispositions that are necessary for fostering and growing in mental prayer. I stopped at 12 predispositions. I'm sure with a little extra time, I could have doubled the number. They are not necessarily in the exact order of importance, but I try to somehow place those that are more primary first and others that kind of derive from the primary later. What do we mean by predispositions for mental prayer? I mean two things. That without these predispositions, there is no mental prayer. And secondly, in the measure in which these predispositions are fostered and cultivated, and I would say very soon in the religious life, in the proportion in which they are fostered, mental prayer grows. They are drawn from the masters of the spiritual life, especially the great saints who have reflected on mental prayer. And I would especially recommend these four saints for methodology in mental prayer. Saint Benedict. The rules of Benedict are the work of genius. Have lost it some 1400 years. Very practical and down to earth. Which may be a little surprising because Benedict, as you know, stressed the liturgical life. But what good is a liturgy without mental prayer? Just going through a series of rituals. So Saint Benedict, the rule of Benedict, available, as you may know, in a very fine English translation by Doubleday, recently published, sells for $1.95, very worth having. Secondly, Saint Ignatius. Saint Ignatius' spiritual exercises are not really meant to be read as a book on the spiritual life. As a former military man, he was practical, clear, and always tried to adapt means to an end. The great spiritual strategist. He has a lot to say about methods of prayer, ways of practicing mental prayer, and the exercises themselves have not been improved on for methodology. Saint Ignatius. Thirdly, Francis de Sales. Francis de Sales, book on the introduction to the devout life, though immediately intended for religious, for lay people, is equally useful for religious. And then, there are The Scattered Writings of Saint Francis. Now, Saint Francis, as we know, did not leave us much that is certainly authentic. The omnibus of Saint Francis contains everything that scholars have discovered is authentic, other things that are not surely authentic, and a great deal about the life of St. Francis, the Fioretti, for example, and the work of Thomas of Celano. At any rate, St. Francis, though he is not theoretical, says especially a lot about predispositions for prayer. You may have to dig to find it, but as one who was brought up by a tertiary mother long before he entered the Jesuits, all I know is that Francis has a lot to say about how you become prayerful. Now, our predispositions. First, knowledge of the faith. The first and indispensable predisposition for prayer is knowledge of the faith. At the meeting we had in St. Louis, the regional meeting of our affiliates, last Friday, I asked the major superiors, I was chaperoning the meeting, to suggest problems which they thought we should then discuss for the rest of the day. Do you know what their first problem was? The lack of knowledge of the faith among the religious or the young people coming into religious life today. They believe the single biggest problem for young people entering is religious illiteracy.
I think not only is the lack of knowledge of faith, oftentimes it's a lack of knowledge of authentic church doctrine.
It's mixed up with error,
yes,
and interlarded with all kinds of unauthentic theory, right?
I've experienced, believe it or not, even a mixture of Christianity and Buddhism.
Oh, how well I know. Indeed.
And they think that's Catholic doctrine.
Well, take, for example, this Genesis 2. You've heard about it. Genesis 2 is Simon pure Hinduism. The basic premises of Genesis 2, as one who has been teaching Hinduism for the last 18 years. And I know it. The principles are Vedic, from the Hindu Vedas. All sorts of pious Christian vocabulary, but the underlying metaphysics is an evolutionary pantheism. By the way, may I recommend to all of you, if you haven't done this, read it soon. Read Catechesi Tridente of Pope John Paul II. As you know, it is a very clear, rather lengthy, but clear exhortation. I think it's called Apostolic Exhortation for Teaching of the Faith. And among the persons whom the Holy Father says we should begin teaching of the faith is religious. Time and again in the document, he says the single greatest need of the church today is knowledge of the true faith. So, knowledge of the faith. Now, this is not meditation. It's already mental prayer. This is just sheer knowledge of the faith. And I'm told you can presume on almost nothing nowadays. In other words, They need to know, many of them, just about everything, brother.
If I might suggest you, Father, a good preamble to any catechetical presentation is Pope Paul VI's Credo, which summarizes our Catholic faith today.
Present Holy Father says, this is the faith of the Church, of my predecessor, Pope Paul VI. And the beauty of that credo, first of all, it's longer than the Nicene Creed, for example. The beauty of it is that it highlights especially those areas of the faith that are currently challenged and that need a special attention to make sure that people believe them and understand them. I would say regarding this number one, and we have 11 to go, that this knowledge of the faith means not only assenting to the faith, it also means understanding the faith. This aspect of knowledge of the faith has, I believe, been widely neglected, and in my opinion, is one of the contributing causes to the chaos in so many otherwise Catholic circles today. Rote memory, memorization is very important, but rote memory does not substitute for grasping the meaning of the faith. As I must have told some of you more than once, read and meditate on Christ's parable of the sower. Remember? Where Christ speaks, I just hope I will find it at a jiffy. Yes, I found it. Chapter 13 of Matthew. The parable of the sower from Chapter 13, verse 4, up to verse 23, one of the longest parables in the Gospels. Evidently, an important parable. Let me read a few lines, because it touches immediately on this knowledge of the faith. He said, imagine a sower going out to sow. As he sowed, some seeds fell on the edge of the path, and the birds came and ate them up. Others fell on patches of rock, where they found little soil and sprang up straight away, because there was no depth of earth. But as soon as the sun came up, they were scorched, and not having any roots, they withered away. Others fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Others fell on rich soil and produced their crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. Listen, anyone who has ears. Then, a long interlude. They asked him, Lord, would you please explain what this parable is all about? Only the first of the four types of soil pertains to us. You therefore are to hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom without understanding, the evil one comes and carries off what was sown in his heart. That is the man who received the seed on the edge of the path. In Christ's estimation, this is the Son of God telling us, the principal reason why God's revelation, otherwise known as the Word of God, does not bear fruit is because people receive the Word of the kingdom without understanding. So, this first condition for prayer is knowledge of the faith, of course, knowing what to believe, but also understanding what and why and how I am to carry my faith into practice. In a word, understanding is more than merely believing. Second, in order to pray the way we should, we must think of God, thinking of God. You know the difference between knowledge of the faith and thinking of God. Knowledge of the faith is, evidently, that habitual acquisition of information about God and the things of God that God's revelation gives us. But knowledge, by presupposition, is a habitual and, in its own way, passive state of mind. Thinking of God is actuating this knowledge. What do I do when I think of God? Well, I may believe in God, but if I want to think of God, I must make an effort, an act of the will, to put God on my mind and keep him there. Let me explain a little further. We've all heard more than once that we love only what we know, and we serve only the person or the ones whom we love. Referring to God, my service of God will depend on my love of God. My love of him will depend on my knowledge of God. But stating that as a psychological principle, in the practical order, that knowledge, which I say is the foundation for love, which itself is a precondition for service, that knowledge must be active. Otherwise, I will not actually be loving God. Consequently, if I am to pray, I have no choice. I must put and keep thoughts of God on my mind. All prayer begins in the mind. Prayer, properly so called, is not merely thinking of God. But without thought of God, I will not ever pray to God. Now, as we know, in this, especially in the early years of formation, a person must be trained to control his or her thoughts. Otherwise, the inevitable happens. What or whom we have on our minds is the what or whom we will have in our hearts. I do not speak to people who are not somehow in my affection, and they won't be in my affections unless they are first in my thoughts. Now, this in practice, as we know, means that a person must have practiced considerable self-abnegation in keeping other persons, places, and things off the mind. Thinking of God means, in practice, not thinking of creatures. And since we are so naturally prone to think of creatures, beginning with the one creature who is never off our mind, except with a special effort and a lot of grace, and you know who. I've asked many people now, when was the last time you dreamt about somebody else? Every person I've ever asked, all the books I've ever written on dream psychology, I'm informed we are always somehow the center even of our dreams. So this is something which a person must work at. Let me tell you this, and I've seen it, even after years in the religious life. Unless this interior life, this is the interior life, that's where it starts, in the mind. Unless this is cultivated early, self-abnegation means mainly abnegation in not so much thinking about myself. Without a second question, the moment we hear the word thoughtless, what do we mean? A person who is so preoccupied with self, he or she is thoughtless of others, right? Without asking what the word means, we all know what thoughtful means. A thoughtful person is one who thinks of others. So the language, and this is by the way of all nations, thoughtfulness is thinking of others. Thoughtlessness is preoccupation with self. Unless religious, early in their days, are helped and trained to be more thoughtful and less thoughtless, here's what may happen. They can go through the externals of the religious life. And if they're shrewd and selfish, they say to themselves, this is pretty good. 3 square meals a day, good company, nice surroundings, organized life, respect from others, sense of achievement, but may never have really lived the true interior life. That's why some saints, Teresa of Avila, simply identify a strong spiritual life by the person's life of prayer. And it begins in the mind. All I can tell you is that unless people are alerted to this soon, they may go through many of the externals of the religious life, what I call the mechanics of spirituality, and not have come to grips with the spiritual life, properly so called, unless they first reflect on their thoughts. A regular daily inventory of one's mind I consider essential to growth in the spirit. How much is God on my mind? Now, this is a very important item. May I spend a few more minutes? There is a principle in scholastic philosophy which says there is nothing in the mind that has not first been in the senses. We will not, therefore, think about God interiorly unless we've made sure, and each one must do this for him or herself, there must be, and the word is prosaic, but it's very important, unless we constantly remind ourselves of God. There must be things outside of me that speak to me of God. This is why we wear a religious habit. This is why we have crucifixes. Oh, I was afraid there wasn't a crucifix in this room. I am pleased to say there is. Otherwise, before the beginning of class, we would have got one. Have any of you visited and remember what you saw in the Washington Cathedral, Washington, D.C.? Next time you're in Washington, look around and weep. They've removed all the statues from the Washington Cathedral. The niches are there, the pedestals are there, but the statues are gone. What I call modern iconoclasm. Now,
a lot of poor people contributed to those.
Sure they did. But we all need, don't misunderstand me, I don't mean we need 1,000 statues in a small church. All right? Proportion, art, balance, all of those things are, you might say, common. Supernatural sense. But we do need the sacred in art and architecture.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.